Let's talk about the Jules Holland Rhythm and Blues Orchestra, which is an amazing band. Anybody who's watched Jules Holland is like, oh, you know, that's the band you'd all musicians would love to be in. How did you get involved with that band? How did it come about?
It was slightly by accident, but not quite. At the time, I knew several of the people that were in the band. You never know where your next opportunity is. So a lot of people say, you know, but people say, oh, you must be in the right place at the right time. No, the answer is always be in the right place, and eventually one of them will be the right time. So here I was doing a very badly paid gig in a cellar bar in North London, but I really liked the musicians I was working with. Huge fun. Fantastic. It was Ronnie Golden. The band's called Ronnie and the Rex, a kind of comedy rhythm and blues soul review show. Great fun. I'd, you know, the money wasn't important. I was having a great time playing with the band. The trumpet player in that band is a guy called Jason McDermid. And when Pete Long left the band, Jason was one of the people that said, oh, you should audition Derek and see what he's like. So by doing a tiny little gig in a basement, someone personally recommended me for the Jules job. The same thing happened with the lead alto player, Lisa Graham. I used to work for the Bootleg Beatles. So I did a couple of tours with them. And then I put Lisa in as a debt for me for a couple of gigs I couldn't do, and they liked her very much so. And then eventually Lisa ended up taking over that gig, so she was always grateful that I'd passed on work to her for that, and she also personally recommended me. Now, that's the recommendation. That's the help. That's the leg up. I got a phone call from the manager, said, would you like to audition? I said, yeah, of course, I'd love to. What I thought audition meant was a little rehearsal room somewhere, send a tape in. No. They said, all right, Friday night, Kew Gardens, 2,500 people, you're on. And that was it. And that was sink or swim. You really had to go out there. Now, I don't know. I know they tried a couple of other people before me. But in a strange kind of way, I felt so at home immediately because if anyone's ever seen me perform, I can't stand still. I kind of dance around. I enjoy myself. I talk to the audience a lot. I feel the energy of the music whenever, every gig. You know, it's not an act, the kicking the leg out and all that business. It's just what happens. Lots of people do it. So everyone has always said, oh, God, can you not keep still and all that? And I got to the Jules band, and I felt so comfortable because everybody, it's like a party on stage every night. It is. It's that kind of band. It's a huge party, and the energy needs to be transmitted to the audience, and the audience's energy comes back to you, and it's just huge fun. As soon as we go on stage, it's great fun. It's full of lovely, genuine people who have all sorts of diverse musical talents. And that's what makes the band so interesting. We're not all schooled session musicians. Some people come from totally different musical backgrounds, but we all bring something new and unique to that band.
Now I'm going to hand you over now. Sebastian's been here on Work Experience for this week, just on my show, and he's an absolute star and a saxophone player as well. So he's got a few questions.
I was just wondering, has it always been jazz? Like, did you start off playing that? I mean, every musician I know has always began on classical and stuff, and when did you kind of start playing jazz and found that you have a passion for it?
It's certainly not always been jazz, and I would still advise any musician at any stage to play any music, and it doesn't matter what you've been offered. So over the years, one of my first things was playing in a wind band, so I would be playing Sousa marches and themes from West End shows, and we'd just be doing all sorts of just tunes, and I wasn't no jazz whatsoever. I just had to play what was on the page. Point and Centre Military Band, we were called, and that was one of my first gigs on saxophone when I was probably about 14 years old. My parents would religiously take me up to Poynton every week, and I'd go and practice with them. I then joined Stockport School's Stage Sound, which was, again, that was more kind of Glenn Miller, Duke Ellington, so I started to hear some of that stuff. And then there would be small opportunities for little bits of jazz at that, which I then got the bug for. But in my time, I've played timpani in the school orchestra, I've played bassoon in the school orchestra, I've played classical things. I did, quite recently, I did Eric Coates, who wrote the Dam Busters March. I did a thing called Saxo Rhapsody. It's actually a whole piece that he wrote for Sigmund Rascher, the famous 1930s saxophone player, and it's done for orchestra, but I did it a cinema organ and alto saxophone concert in Southampton Town Hall, and again, that was really hard. I really had to concentrate. But every music you play anywhere, you'll learn. You'll either learn something about the discipline, or you'll learn something about playing in tune, or you'll learn how to react with other musicians and other musicians that come from different disciplines around with you. You'll learn what the bits you love and the bits you don't, but even the bits you don't, at least, you know, I hate this when someone slags another band off or say, oh, that's dreadful, that's rubbish. Well, have you actually heard it? I will listen to any music anywhere because I want to be informed. And even from obscure music that I wouldn't normally listen to, like rap or reggae or stuff like this, if you open your ears, there's always something great. And the other thing I've discovered is when I played jazz almost exclusively till I got to London, and then I joined a soul band, and they couldn't believe that I didn't know. I didn't really know anything about James Brown or Sam and Dave. A Mustang Sally was a mystery. I'd never played it. And it was just, I'd grown up in the wrong sort of social environment to have learnt about all those tunes. My parents never listened to any of that, so I never learnt it. So I suddenly had to learn a whole thing of soul music. And people say, oh, it's so simple, soul music. It's just three or four chords. No, when you get a good soul band, it's all about the timing and the poise. Yeah. And I think that's what makes music special. It's about a human being's timing, the elegance and the poise and exactly where they put the notes. Because if a computer plays music, it just sounds rigid. There's no life to it. But when human beings play music, it's that timing element that makes it so special. So play any music anywhere. And I've always learnt something by playing music, even when I've been out of my comfort zone.
We're going to play a track, and it's track number 9, which is Corona.
Corona. It's called the Picante Latin Band, Picante. Yeah. And we're playing in Southend. We're doing the jazz mix, it's called it, in the Maritime Rooms underneath the Cliffs Pavilion.
Yeah.
24th of February, I think. This is an interesting project. It was a writing project with a fabulous guitar player called Dominic Ashworth, who plays with Digby Fairweather a lot. And we started writing Latin music, specifically for the library music market. Now, this is music to be used on radio and television. So the whole idea is you write something that sounds in vogue with a particular style. So we really tried to stretch the boundaries. We wrote something that sounded like Buena Vista Social Club. We wrote something that sounded like Spara Jara. We wrote something that sounded like Stan Getz and Astro Gilberto. We wrote something that sounded like Mongo Santa Maria. And it's a real interesting exercise to try and work out what makes each one of those styles fantastic and try and capture it. It's hard. We spent, as soon as I started playing some of these tunes on gigs, there was a demand for it.
Yeah.
So we now have a live band just to play all this original Latin material. But this particular track, Corona, was very exciting because I'd known that some of it's been used on a Japanese television drama somewhere. I'm sure everyone in Essex has heard that. It's regularly out there when you're ill in Japan. So, I mean, that's nice. It's great to know the music is being used on television. Anyway, I was out, and my phone suddenly started ringing. It was my wife, and I thought, why is she phoning me this time? Is there some dramatic thing? And I picked up the phone. She said, it's on! It's on now! You're on! It's Picante! And she was so excited. And we were on Strictly Come Dancing.
Wow.
Which was fantastic. So it was one of their film excerpts.
Yep.
And they said, what we'd like to do is take you to an authentic flamenco club if you're going to learn how to play flamenco properly.
Yep.
And then suddenly they played this track.
Oh, wow.
It's just fantastic.
That's fantastic. I'm a massive fan. Strictly Come Dancing, Derek, it's one of those programmes you always think that I could do that, and then literally you get up to make a cup of tea while somebody's doing something and you just can't barely walk.
No.
It's one of those things where you think you could do it, but you can't. No. And that's a tremendous band as well, isn't it?
The live band, Dave Archer's band. Absolutely fantastic. Yeah. I've played with a few of those guys, and it's huge. Trevor Barry, the bass player, I do quite a few things with him. They're just an amazing band.
Leanne Carroll, who you obviously know, she did an online thing to make sure that the people who sing in the band, because they were never kind of introduced, and now they introduce the vocalist on Strictly Come Dancing as well.
Fantastic. Yeah. Well, that's great. They are some of the finest musicians this country's got.
Yeah.
And I know what that workload is to put together a television show like that.
Yeah.
Because they will just have to come in and sight read it and rehearse it. It has to be note perfect and rhythm perfect so quickly.
Yeah.
Yeah, my admiration for that band is unparalleled.
And here we go. Here's you again with Corona.
This is our flamenco club music.
absolutely fantastic. That was Corona there, and that was also with Mark Cecil, who is an amazing percussionist, drummer, Andy Staples on bass.
Actually, no, the album is Jeff Gascoigne on bass.
Oh, sorry.
But Andy Staples plays in the live band. It's one of those things where Jeff came and did all the studio sessions for us, but he's ridiculously busy working with people like Michel Legrand. But he's the guy, bass player you heard on the You've Got to Dig It, Jeff Gascoigne, so he's on both of those, I'm afraid. But Andy Staples plays with us live, and he'll be down at Win the Maritime Rooms on the 24th. So that's the Jazz Mix, are running a gig down there. So Bacanti will be there, and dancing is obligatory. You have to. And that's also, heard an amazing trumpet player called Chris Storr there, who's one of the Jules Holland Rhythm and Blues Orchestra trumpet players, and also does the Strictly Come Dancing tour. So whenever you go to any of the stadiums, he plays on that tour as well. So we're mixing all the genres here. I mean, obviously, I get the odd day off here and there. I'm very lucky that I've got several strings to my bow. So I've got the Jules Holland. I think we've already got 60, 70 gigs in the book for this forthcoming year to start with. I've been running Sax Appeal for, 35 plus now, and I'm scared to think. I obviously started the band when I was 2 years old. You understand that? I was a teenager when I started the band. But that's still running. Protect the Beat, the funk band. I've got that. I've got the acoustic quartet that you heard, and we're doing all the major jazz clubs around the country. And then the Picanti band has taken off as well. And then I'm on that circuit where you play with house rhythm sections. So I am the guest. So I often travel up and down the country, not quite sure. In fact, I'm doing one this coming Saturday. We're in Hadley in Suffolk, where George Double's running a rhythm section. I also played with him at Felixstowe last Sunday evening. And then I'm playing at Googly's Jazz. I'm all over the place. And that's great, because it just means that lots of things will keep happening. And it means for me, my musical life is very varied. So I'm not playing with exactly the same band night after night. So I'm always being challenged. I've got a straight ahead rhythm and blues night tonight in Crayford. If anyone wants to venture over the water, come and find the Charlotte Pub in Crayford. I'm playing with Gambler, who is actually the soul. You know, remember I said I joined a soul band? I had to learn very quickly about how to play James Brown music. That was the basis of that. Was Gambler Soul Survivors, we were called, and the nucleus of that band. I'm playing with them tonight. Good old friends. We're going to play with Mickey Ash.
Mucky Mash, as he calls himself sometimes.
Absolutely. And we'll be playing down in Charlotte in Crayford tonight, and I think it's free entry. And coming to hear some R&B classics, and I'll be doing a bit of soul and a bit of blues, and see what happens.
Excellent. Now, I want to talk to you about your gigs. So we've all, as musicians, and you will find this as well, Sebastian, when you start doing your gigs, what was the best gig and what has been the worst gig? Because there must be just one gig that you go, oh no, what happened? And sometimes the band can sound fantastic, but you just think, what's wrong with the audience? So
obviously, when you play with your musical heroes, that's an incredible moment. So although I've never performed live with David Sanborn, who's one of my saxophone heroes, I have recorded two tracks with him in the studio with the Jules Holland Band, and Jules let me do the arrangements and basically be musical director of the day. So I spent all day with David Sanborn, and we went out for dinner in the evening with him and his management and Jules, and that was an amazing day. Other highlights for me are playing in America with people like Russell Ferranti and Dave Grusin, again, two heroes of mine. Dave Grusin had GRP Records, played on Mountain Dance, wrote the music for On Golden Pond, Goonies, Mrs. Robinson, that film. I forgot what it's called now. The Graduate. He wrote all the incidental music for that. And I loved all his stuff, Mountain Dance, and him and his brother, Dave and Don Grusin, to play with those two in the States. And them playing some of my original compositions, to have them playing my tunes, was incredible. Eric Clapton, you can never forget the first time you play with Eric Clapton. I had a wonderful few years playing with Jack Bruce recently, sadly before he passed away. I was in his European band, and to play Sunshine of Your Love with the bloke that wrote it is a very it was a very amazing thing. Same as when I did Soul Man with Sam Moore from Sam and Dave, to actually play it, to do Oops Upside Your Head with Charlie Wilson from the Gap Band. To do those things with the real people are amazing moments. They're huge career highlights. Each one is a very special thing. And for me personally, because I'm of that era, when I played All the Young Dudes with Ian Hunter from Motley Hoople. And I've done I Wish It Could Be Christmas with Roy Wood. You know, all those things, to do the original song with the original person, they're all highlights. They're amazing moments. And I had amazing moments with my own band. Some of the places we've played, went to Venezuela with Sax Appeal. And that was incredible, playing in a stadium over there. To be with Jules Holland and play the Sydney Opera House.
Yeah.
Things like that, things that you just never believe you'd get then, things like that. But there are other sides.
So what was the one that sticks out in your mind? Have you thought of all the gigs you've done over the year that you just thought, oh, that was, you know, you can laugh about it now?
I've had things where things go catastrophically wrong on stage. I certainly remember one where I started doing a jazz standard. I'd mentioned to the audience jokingly that, oh yes, this is more complicated than the last jazz standard, because the last 8 is not an 8, it's actually a 12-bar phrase with a tag on it. That was just to remind the piano player what was going on, to make sure they had it up. And we started the tune, and even before the end of the first chorus, it was going. What was going on behind me was wrong.
Yeah.
And then we got to my solo, and the bass player's amp stopped working. So it just went crackle, splat, and nothing. No bass. So I've now got drums and the piano, and the piano keeps consistently going wrong.
Yeah.
And I didn't know what to do, and I was trying to, every time the bridge came along, I just had to wait till he got to where he thought the bridge was, and then try and join in. Mm. So I did this solo that was, I was trying desperately, I felt like I was on a sinking ship all the way through. And I finished my solo, and I just thought, I'm just going to bail out at this stage, I can't do any more. And I stopped, and I turned around. At that point, the bass player's amp, he managed to get it back working again, so the bass came back. I then walked over to the piano player, saw page 2 of the music, which he had on the floor next to him, and said, there's the rest of the music, this will make it work properly now.
Yes.
He then did his solo, which sounded fine because he had a bass part and the correct music. So I do remember that moment. I remember being in the Rock Garden in Covent Garden. I don't even remember who the band was, and that was one of those occasions where I'd done a rehearsal with the band and I'd learnt my parts perfectly and nobody else in the band seemed to know what was going on. There was mistake after mistake. And I very rarely do this, but I remember phoning up the singer and saying, please don't ever call me again. I don't ever want to be put in that situation, because I felt utterly foolish. And that's 25 years ago now.
Yeah.
I don't think it's happened since then. But we've all done stupid things. I did saxograms when I was young. That's on my website, so I can't lie about that. When you need a bit of money, I used to rush in with a bow tie and a dinner jacket and a bunch of flowers and play happy birthday to somebody.
Yeah.
I remember some poor girl in a shoe shop. She looked utterly embarrassed. She said, you ain't going to take your clothes off, are you? I said, no, it's all right. Don't worry, it's just a bunch of flowers.
No, it's an extra £20 for that. Yeah. Sorry,
So, yes, we've all done things.
I was going to mention, you said Paul McCartney, Tom Jones, working with Amy Winehouse. What did you actually work with her? What was she like?
First time we worked with her, she was absolutely fantastic and a lovely, lovely girl, and just down to earth and fun. And she, but the second time, the last time we did one of the Hootenanny, and that was the one with Paul Weller, she still sung, she still performed, but basically she was, how can I say, she was no longer with us. Whatever she was on that, with a couple of days that we were working with her, you just couldn't really get through to her as a human being, which is such a waste. Yeah. She still had the talent, and the talent was so raw that she could still produce the goods. If you check out, it's on YouTube somewhere, the version of Don't Go to Strangers that she does with Paul Weller on the Hootenanny TV record is amazing.
Yeah.
But she wasn't really with us that day, I have to say. I don't know where she was.
Yeah.
But she could still do the do. It's only right at the very end that I think she lost the ability to perform as well, which is such a shame. Because really, basically, she, early Amy Winehouse is like the way that Paloma Faith is now. Yeah. Just a bundle of raw energy, huge fun, totally up for it, loves the band. And early Amy Winehouse was like that.
Yeah.
It's a shame. Terrible loss, because she was fantastic.
Now, you've got Clown's Pocket Recording Studio. So how long has that been going for? Because that's your own personal recording studio, and people go in and do sessions, including Jamie Cullen.
Yeah, I did Jamie's Pointless Nostalgic album at the studio, and that was the album that really broke him. He got the deal with Candid Records with that, and then straight on to Warner Brothers. That came about through Jeff Gascoigne, actually, the bass player you've already heard. He's been very influential in my life, the bass player from my acoustic quartet and on the Big Anti CD. He met Jamie at a workshop, just like the Essex Jazz Workshop that we're about to do. And that just goes to prove, you never know when the opportunity is going to arise. Jamie turned up at a workshop and said, I don't know if I'm any good, but I like it. And Jeff said,
I
know. But then that's it. That's the way it happened. And so Jeff actually brought Jamie into my studio. So that's 15 years ago. I can't remember when Pointless Nostalgia was. Maybe 2001, I think it was. So that would be coming up for 15 years. And I'd had the studio for 5 years before that. And he just did one track on a Jeff Gascoigne solo album. And he was fantastic.
Mm.
And we made good friends. In fact, I saw Jamie recently. How about this for name dropping? This is a pure fluke. The Ronnie Scott's Blues Explosion. Normally we play every month at Ronnie Scott's on a Sunday night. They moved us on to a Monday night. We thought, we move on to a Monday night. Probably won't get an audience. Actually, we got a great audience.
Mm.
On the morning, they phoned us up and said, "You're not doing two sets tonight. You're only doing one set, and you've got to finish early." I said, "Why? What have we done something wrong?" He said, "No. Prince is going to be on stage that night." And remember when he did those gorilla gigs? He performed at Ronnie Scott's, and that happened to be the night I was playing there.
Oh, wow.
So I got to stay and see both shows till 4 a.m.
Yep.
So I got to see Prince as close as I am to you now. And stay. And it was just one of those unique things that happened.
Yeah.
But after we finished Ronnie Scott's, all the celebs started turning up. And Jamie turned up with Sophie and Stephen Fry and Kate Moss and all those people. And we're all huddled upstairs in Ronnie Scott's office, which is just like this office. It's just desks and a few computers, sipping wine and just chatting, because Prince wouldn't allow anybody in the place while he was rehearsing and sound checking. And then we all went down and saw the show. Mm. So that was the last time I saw Jamie at the Gorilla Gigs. But he's ever so lovely. In fact, he played the track that you played, the "You've Got to Dig It to Dig It, You Dig" track, on his radio show, and was very complimentary. And he talked about the days in the studio when we worked together. He's always been a lovely chap, totally down to earth.